Hey everybody, Rob Maurer here, and today we are fortunate to be joined by the remarkably insightful Pierre Ferragu, as Elon Musk would put it. Pierre and team released a note last week to just walk through some of Tesla's return on investment, how they're generating operating leverage over time. And I thought, Pierre, we could just start by going through a little bit of that note and maybe just why this is such a complicated topic for Tesla. Why do people have so much difficulty, you know, getting to the core of this operating leverage concept for Tesla and, you know, digging through all the difficult numbers here?
Yeah. Thanks, Robin. Thanks for the kind comments and for echoing the very kind comments of Elon last week that probably made my week, I have to admit. So, I mean, profitability is always a very, actually a very, much more complex topic than you would think at first. So we think we have like the good like accounting and financial tools to look at the profitability of a business with notions of free cash flow, notions of you know, profit and loss statement, and things like that. But the reality is that these tools are always very, very, very partial. And as time goes, they're getting less and less fit to really understand the business. So if you look at the case of Tesla, so Tesla is spending a lot of money to build out a factory. So if you look at free cash flow, the free cash flow is going to be massively impacted by building out a factory that other car manufacturers have, you know, built maybe 50 years ago. That's one thing. And then you could say, okay, then let's look at the P&L. But even in the P&L, your factory is being depreciated through like a variety of rules. But roughly what it means is the overall cost of the factory is, let's say, split over a 5 or 10 year period. But when you get started, your factory is actually producing a very small number of cars. So the cost of the factory per car becomes fairly fairly significant. And then you have more intricate movements, like, you know, how to reflect stock-based compensation. So the fact that Tesla gives shares to employees or to Elon, how do you reflect that on the P&L? And there is no good way to do it. It's not like that the guys who decided the rule are morons. It's just that there is no good way to do it. It's a very, like, if you give a share to an employee, is that worth the value of the share today, the value of the share tomorrow? Is that actually worth nothing because your equity is going to grow that much over the next in the years before this employee can get the share effectively? So there is no good way to do it, and there is one accounting way to do it, and you have to deal with it. So it's always very complicated. And in today's world, things are accelerating. So you see, let's take another example than Tesla. You take Uber. So Uber is not a business in which you invest in capex, because that's not a business owning significant tangible assets. But for Uber to be successful, they have actually to ramp up in any given market, in any city, very, very fast to make sure that they are number one in the race that is going to end into one number one surviving and one number two surviving and all other players disappearing. And the only way you can accelerate that expansion is through spending a lot of money, attracting drivers, attracting riders, getting people to download your app, et cetera, et cetera. All these costs are going through the P&L, right? But the reality is that there are investments into building a number one position, which is something that barely existed in the past. It's a new type of intangible capital accounting doesn't even capture. So if you want to be an investor in Uber, you need to look at, so if you look at it like my old style clients look at it and are like, well, they have like an EBITDA margin of minus 25%. Why are they worth $50 billion? And then you have to go through the business model and have an intimate understanding of the business model, what the money is spent for, And at the end of the day, I think I have one magical principle, which I call, you know, evaluating the right to make money of a business. And to evaluate the right to make money of a business, financially, what you need to do is isolate the money that business is investing, putting in the ground. So for Tesla, it's relatively easy. That's mostly CapEx. But for Uber, that's money put in new markets where they haven't reached, you know, the number one position. Then once you have that, you look at the cash you need to run your operation on an annual basis, like paying your employees, paying your supplies, your cost of goods sold, etc. And then you look at the cash you generate, selling your service or your product. And if you do that last number minus the previous one, so cash in minus cash out, and you divide it by the cash you put in the ground, that gives you an idea of how much return you will get per year for every dollar you put in the ground. And that's a very powerful metric. For like a traditional business, it's called cash return on operating assets. And so why cash return? It's because if you look at returns without taking into account the cash component, you take the risk of actually getting some like accounting corrections that don't make sense. If you look at really cash in and cash out, it gives you a good ability of how much cash you can get it now for something you just did now and don't include, you know, in its movements in working capital and things like that. And then you look at operating assets because, you know, if a business is spending money to make an acquisition, has, you know, a lot of retained earnings on its balance sheet, it's very important from the perspective of you as a shareholder evaluating how much this business is going to return to you. But in terms of evaluating the quality of the business itself, it doesn't really make a difference. You know, whether you redistribute your earnings or retain them or whatever, it doesn't change your actual rights to make money. Okay. So we did that for Tesla, and I'm going to share some slides to show you some of the numbers. And so the way we did it is looking at over the last 5 years. So every year you have operating cash flow. So that's basically not the free cash flow. That's your cash flow before you spend money on your CapEx. Okay, so that's really the cash you get out of your operation. And that number like was kind of break even early in 2018 and kept expanding over the last 3 years. And then to look at operating assets, we look at the value of Tesla's plant and properties and equipment, PPEs. We look also at all the assets they use that they don't have on their balance sheet, but that they lease to another economic entity. You know, if like they don't own their fab in China, but lease it and things like that, then we have disclosures giving us the value of these assets. We add working capital, of course, for an industrial business, it's very important. Like, I mean, you look at in 2020, that was $7 billion for Tesla. So that's, what you have in your inventories, in your unfinished goods, in your receivables, etc. And also you keep in mind, you keep in check, you know, the amount of cash you need to run your business, and all that gives you your operating assets. And so that number for Tesla is close to $24 billion, and Tesla generated last year $4.4 billion of operating cash flow. So that's a 20% return. Okay,
that's excluding regulatory credits, right?
And so this is always something I forget to mention, and you see it's ending up as a footnote at the bottom right of the table, because yes, of course, like in my whole 10-year covering Tesla, I have never ever looked at regulatory credits. Regulatory credits are basically, a cherry in the cake Tesla as an operation gets. So it's access to cash. It helps Tesla, you know, go through its initial ramp without calling too much capital, because they had additional cash to help them float through ramping their first fab. But in terms of, you know, the value of the business and the right to make money off Tesla, it's of course not sustainable. So we completely completely ignore it. So when you look at the economics with that perspective, you don't look at any financial costs or profits. So like if you make money selling bitcoins or if you lose money selling bitcoins, it's not going to show up in these numbers. You don't look at anything related to your share count, to a change in your share count. So if you grant shares to your employees and your CEO, that's not part of that. And so as a shareholder, that's something you need to analyze separately. It's just looking at your business. And it's basically telling you, for every dollar you put in the ground so far, taking into account also the fact that what you put in the ground 5 years ago is worth much less today, so it depreciated over time. Here is the number of cents you can generate in cash going forward. And so once you have this number, you can't really conclude anything. Like this 20%, if it were 5% or 35%, I wouldn't be able to comment more. Where it becomes really interesting is that when you start looking at the dynamics of that number. And so here, for Tesla, there are two things we've done. The first one is, you know for sure it is a fact that Tesla generates 20% return on their fab in 2020. But now you know that in 2020, Tesla is not fully utilizing their fabs. And you have a tool to figure out that part of the equation very simply. You say, let's take 2020, the same asset base, and then let's just run the fab at full capacity, so producing 1 million cars. And let's keep all the other elements of the economics exactly the same. So you produce cars the same way. Nothing is changed. And then that gives you 37% return on operating assets. So this is a fantastic insight, because before that analysis, you're like, yeah, okay, their free cash flow is low or whatever, or excluding credit and Bitcoin, their quarter's EPS was 70% less, and who cares? They run fabs today where they make 20 cents, they've made $1 of investment. And when they have fully loaded these fabs, these very same assets will not generate 20 cents, but 37 cents. And then there will be a lot of other moving parts, because in the meantime, they will start investing in other assets to build additional plants and things like that. But you will still be able to track these numbers very accurately.
Right. So if we fast forward to next year, we're not actually going to see the metric be 37%, because Tesla's going to keep investing. But the important point is that if they were to stop investing, that's what it would show.
Exactly. So that gives you a very good view on the financial performance of Tesla's operation today. And so that gives you a very good sense for the quality of the model. So all these institutional investors who were like shorting Tesla a few years ago, they were not looking at it like that. They were thinking, this company is heading into a wall. They are burning $1 billion a quarter. You're like, no, they are investing like $3 billion a quarter, and they're generating only $2 billion out of operations. That's very different to burning $1 billion a quarter. And in order to understand that, you need to do that kind of math. And we did that kind of math actually in 2018. And while everybody was absolutely certain that Tesla would have like a liquidity crisis in June, we say no, because they are going to start building cars, and they're going to get that cash in before they have to pay their supplies. So they're going to get $1 billion extra cash on their balance sheet with like a negative movement in working capital. And so you see these things coming if you look at a business like that. And that's something that tends to be lost very very easily in the way investors, even sophisticated investors who are used to cover companies in much later stage of development, can easily forget that. Because if you look at a business that has been running around for 50 years, doing that doesn't really make sense. You can do it on BMW. it's going to be intellectually interesting, but it's not going to give you any valuable insights. Whereas for Tesla, it tells you the whole story. Then you have another way to look at it, which is on the right of that slide, which is looking at the metric on an incremental basis. So instead of looking at all your assets and all your cash generated, you look at assets you put in the ground in the last year and how much you've grown your cash. So it tells you for every additional dollar you're putting in the ground today, what return should you expect next year? And here again, this is a metric that is 100% calculated on reported numbers. So there are no estimates or no discretionary way I can define it. And that number comes out at 90%. So it's particularly generous in 2020 because you've had favorable movements of working capital. As you know, you've had production stopping and restarting, and these things actually created a fairly favorable environment for that metric. But that gives you an idea that of the dollars you've put in the ground in the past, on average, you make 20 cents. But every additional dollar you put in the ground, you're making 90 cents. So yes, of course, over time, your return is going to improve. And so that return is going to improve. Now, what's really interesting is to say, okay, so what does that tell us in terms of profitability? So here is like our forecast on Tesla. And you see that in 2020, we have this 16% operating cash flow margin. And you're saying, let's keep, you know, that number kind of flattish. And so we have it in mid-teens all the way to 2023. Okay. In the meantime, you have this capacity utilization that is improving. So even if you're still adding additional fabs, the amount of fabs that are empty is shrinking as a percentage of total. So today, half the fabs are not producing, basically. And in 3 years, it will be only 25% of the fab or 20% of the fabs not producing. And so your return on operating assets is indeed increasing every year, even if your cash margin doesn't change. So the cash margin says for every $100 I get from selling a car, I will have roughly $85 of cash to pay out, to pay for my suppliers and everything, and I can keep $15 for myself. That number is not, I'm saying, in our forecast, it's not changing. It's actually pretty conservative because today, Tesla, even from a cash perspective, like when you ramp up new production in China, ramp up, are in the middle of changing, you know, a product, some products like the Model S and the Model X, you actually incur, you probably spend cash less efficiently than you could over time. So you could argue that number should increase, the 15% would become 20% over time, but you don't even do that. But if that number remains, that margin remains stable, your returns almost double because your asset utilization is doubling. And that means that on your P&L, your operating margin, the one that is reported that flows into the EPS that everybody is following, is actually going to expand. So this is the kind of insight we're getting here. Assuming Tesla keeps going on a cash basis as it is going today, not better, margins can only improve. There is no...
You're talking bottom line net income margins.
Yeah. Yep. The net income, the P&L margin is improving.
Yep.
Because assets, nobody, I mean, if Tesla keeps growing, of course, their fab, their factories are going to get better and better utilized. So you actually, if you defend today that Tesla's margin is not going to expand, that means you're already very negative on the business. That means you think their right to make money is coming down. They will have pressure on prices that they can't push back on cost, or pressure, upward pressure on cost that they can't push back in pricing. Hear what I'm saying, that I think that's my intuition, my sense from speaking to management, that Tesla is going to be quite aggressively passing on into pricing cost improvements. Yep, so that's a safe assumption to do. And then in that case, the cash margin is going to be stable, but the operating margin is actually going to increase. Now, you've seen Tesla increasing prices by $500 increments in many models in the US, which is probably something that is improving cash margin, because this $500 is not reflecting energy. It might be reflecting an additional cost in today's context with supply constraints and things like that, but maybe not. And so maybe this cash margin is actually improving, and things look even better. So that's the beauty of this analysis. Once you have in a table numbers that give you a cash return view on a business, then you can understand very simply, you know, where the business is heading, where it's going, and that's a very powerful. It's a very powerful tool. We do that for Tesla, but for many other companies we cover in tech. And so the last thing I would add is that we cover TSMC. So TSMC is the largest manufacturer of leading edge chips. So any leading edge chip you use in your daily life, which is not an Intel chip, is probably manufactured in TSMC's fabs. And so TSMC's fabs are like the most modern, the most leading edge fabs in every industry in the world. This is in this fab that you take like a piece of wafer that is, five square centimeter large, and the fab is going to put on that piece of silicon 15 billion transistors. This is mind blowing, and they are more or less the only people on earth with Samsung and Intel being able to do that, and they do that in a way that is much more efficient, much more cost efficient than anyone else. And so, and each of these fabs today costs $25 to $30 billion, one fab. So it's the most extreme manufacturing business in the world. And guess what? Our most important investment conviction on TSMC is that TSMC has absolute control on their right to make money. So they do build a fab, and then they decide their price based on, we want to get a 40% return on this fab. And you see that historically, you have only 5 years here, but actually we've done the analysis on 15 years. Over 15 years, TSMC always get between 40 and 45% cash return. In some years, it goes down in the high 30s, like here in 2019. That's just years where semiconductor demand pulls back. And so they build the fab, and oh, too late. We have a bit too much space in our fab. But so they need 2 years to fill it in instead of one. And so every year you have like a dip in the return of TSMC. That means the next year the CapEx comes down and they readjust the size of the fab to actual demand. And that's it. That's the only variation in their economic model. So these guys have absolute pricing power, absolute control on their pricing power. Why is that? That's because they don't have competition. So if you want a leading edge chip, that's where you go. You can try and go to Samsung, but it's like they have only like 3% of the market for a reason. That's because they can't be as reliable and as good as TSMC. Then their product has a very high value added. The value perceived by the client is always going to be much higher than the value, the cost of manufacturing the product. And then they are very differentiated. So like the kind of fab they have, nobody else have them. Now, if you look at Tesla, it's actually, well, they don't really have competition. I mean, they have a lot of like wannabe competition, but they don't really have like that. There are no cars competing with Tesla, EV cars, to be seen around in volumes, being successful, selling through profitably, there are none. They have very high value-added products because it's basically they have like a pricing umbrella set by the traditional premium car industry. So they basically sell a Model 3 for a bit less than what you would pay for an equivalent car from BMW or Daimler or Jaguar, but an IC car. So they have like a pricing umbrella helping them pricing their products. And they have very differentiated fabs. So the way I was looking the other day at an Audi factory for electric cars, and you compare that to like the Tesla factory, and you feel bad for Audi because it's really running long behind Tesla in terms of manufacturing efficiency. So they're actually very similar to TSMC, and that makes a lot of sense to compare, to actually come to that conclusion that TSMC, Tesla doesn't have like the business model, shouldn't have the financial model of a car company. It should have the financial model of TSMC, of course. And I think that's what Elon Musk reacted to when he tweeted about like insight. I think it's a very, very simple insight. It's like, guys, we are talking about a semiconductor fab and not a car fab. And the way Tesla is geared up, is doing R&D, is thinking, you know, the importance of production in their process. It's exactly the model of TSMC. Remember when Elon Musk said when he was like at the deepest point of trouble with ramping Model 3 in Fremont, he said the real difficulty is the fab. Our product is not the car; it's actually the factory. And then he tweeted recently something around the line of along the lines of, it's easy to do a car, to do a prototype, but like ramp up production and you'll see. So all these things come into place and actually make a lot of sense. So that means, in other words, that this kind of 40% return we anticipate over time for Tesla, which corresponds to today's fab being fully utilized, or what you can come to modeling growth out 2-3 years, would put Tesla in the league of TSMC, and actually, that's exactly what would make sense from a fundamental analysis perspective. So, looking at the fundamentals of the business, and then of course, the second comparison we made is against BMW and Daimler. And so here, what we can say is, yes, you could say Tesla is a 20% return business like BMW and Daimler, and that's where they're going to stick forever. But the thing that you know, it's not true. Like, we are talking returns on assets that are sometimes 100 years old, which means they are worth zero in the balance sheet against assets that have all gone into the ground in the last 3 years, more or less. Like, most of the, out of the $24 billion of assets we have here for Tesla, you know, easily half that is less than 3 years old. So it's very, very, very recent assets. And so what this chart tells you is that the financial flexibility of Tesla, the financial power of Tesla, is going to be much, much superior to their competitors. And that's going to be a competitive advantage as well. So if you generate a lot of returns, that means it's much cheaper for you to reinvest. So like that means you're a structural industrial share gainer. You can invest in more capacity than others. So when Daimler and BMW will be investing in fabs to manage or modernizing fabs to do electric cars, it's going to be extremely painful for them. They'll have much less room for maneuver than Tesla to do it. And that's actually a very interesting counterintuitive perspective. I remember conversations with a lot of investors who were telling me that like BMW has like 25 factories, they can modernize them into electric car factories so quickly, it's going to be so difficult for Tesla. Like, this is telling you no, they don't have that much room for maneuver to do that, actually. I'll probably pause here because I've talked through most of the piece, and I'm pretty sure you have a lot of questions.
No, Pierre, honestly, this is fantastic. I'm just soaking all this in, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. This is incredible work, and I think it just shows what, you know, the Tesla bull case and Tesla bulls have been arguing about for, you know, a couple of years and like a couple of simple metrics. And it's super clear. I do want you to go to, I think you've got one more slide here comparing like some of the differences that are also driving this between the companies. I'd love to go through that as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. So we have this kind of health check. So with TSMC, you have this kind of like conceptual view that like the level of innovation, of the uniqueness of the fab of Tesla is comparable to TSMC, so you should expect similar return. It's like, okay, fine. And then you're saying, well, eventually your returns are going to be 2x the return of any other car manufacturer. And then you can think, okay, what's different between the way I do cars and BMW is going to be doing cars in the medium term? And do I fall back on that kind of profitability difference? And so we have this very simple health check on that point from that perspective. So if you look at BMW's EBIT, like in a good year, they are 10%. In a bad year, that's 3%. So 7% is probably like the right kind of like at scale, normalized profitability. And it's not bad at all for a car manufacturer. So let's imagine a BMW who has transitioned to electric and who has protected that right to make money, which is the way they're going to try and do it. So what we know is that BMW is not going to have access to Tesla's cost efficiency on battery manufacturing. They're going to be running behind Tesla. And we've done a lot of work looking at, you know, the kind of marginal energy density advantage of Tesla that you combine with the form factor advantage, the manufacturing advantage, the pack assembly advantage. And we think, you know, like a 20% kind of all-included cost advantage, Tesla is going to maintain that for multiple years. And you apply that to the whole battery pack, it's 3 points of the selling price of the car. And we so that's one easy item to isolate. Then you have another very easy item to isolate, which is that Tesla is selling directly cars and not through a network of dealers. And that's like a three, being on the conservative side, it's a 3 point cost advantage. It's probably more 5 because you have to take into account indirect costs, which is that when you have dealers, you're creating inventories. And when you're creating inventories, you end up hurting your pricing power because at some point you have to discount the car to get rid of it. So it's more difficult to. So we took it on the cautious side, and then there is no marketing spending at Tesla because the product is so unique, and maybe the CEO is so active on Twitter. I don't know that you don't need to spend money on marketing at all. That's 2 points of revenues. So to bridge the gap between a 7% and a 20%, which is where Tesla is heading, you just need to account for 5 points, and in these 5 points, you basically have the product platform. So the fact that Tesla has like a Model Y, a Model 3, a Model S, and a Model X, a Cybertruck, and a Roadster, and that's it, which is an extremely simple product portfolio for like a 3 million units kind of, like we are talking here, Tesla in 2025, so at 3 million units. You know, like BMW has like dozens of models in their portfolio. So the derived complexity from that, manufacturing complexity from that is very expensive. Then you have the manufacturing innovation of Tesla. So like, you know, will like in 5 years from now, BMW have adopted something as efficient as dual casting for the body? Probably not. And on that time horizon, Tesla will probably be doing that for all their cars. And then the same thing like for the, you know, like the structural battery pack innovation and things like that. I think it's very significant. And it's like maybe in 10 years from now or in 20 years from now, it will have eroded away because it's hardware. It's like there is a kind of asymptotic level of innovation on hardware. But like, I mean, today, Apple, from a hardware perspective, is doing things on their phone that nobody else still is doing. So you can protect hardware innovation for a good decade, I think. And then, of course, you have the software element to it. And in the software element, you have the obvious autopilot feature that is much superior on Tesla, probably now innovating and evolving much faster than anywhere else for obvious, you know, like experience and scale reasons. But you also have the software, the deeper software in the car, the fact that Tesla has a single software image for the whole car and can actually evolve it and update it and improve it very, very fast. has a very positive impact on the overall performance of the car. So it's not only the screen experience and the autopilot experience. I learned that in the performance of the battery pack, you have a lot of software. In the driving performance of the car, you have a lot of software. And who would argue with the fact that software, you know, brings a significant tailwind to your margins, because software don't really have like a cost and add value, of course. So it's actually the point of this slide is that things stack up fairly well. The way Tesla can generate superior returns doesn't seem to be challenged by traditional car manufacturers moving to turning their big large scale boats to electric. And what's interesting is that if you look at it over the next 5 years, in 5 years from now, Tesla is going to be the same scale at a similar scale as BMW. So this idea that BMW will have a larger boat will be gone. And the fact that Tesla has a much more modern, much more agile, much more efficient boat is still going to be there. So on a relative basis, things can only improve from where they are for Tesla.
Yeah, I love it. When you look out from here, is this kind of like reinforcing your price target, or has this made you, I know you guys have just held it, is this making you more bullish than when you guys started this analysis?
That's a good question. The essence of this analysis, we actually did it in 2018. But we were focused on, is Tesla going to go bankrupt or face a liquidity crisis or not? So we looked at it from a very different angle, but we knew these moving parts already at the time. And so we had already in our P&L this 20% operating margin forecast. So it's kind of, from that perspective, it's not new news to us. But now, when we said 3 years ago, we think Tesla, actually at the time we were saying Tesla can go to 15% margin. And then given the trajectory they delivered, we at some point said, no, actually 15, it's like they're almost there. So they are going to get to at least 20. What we had not done is taking a step back, looking at 2 or 3 years of reporting and doing a very thorough, you know, health check on, yes, the fundamentals they are displaying today, not in our forecast, but in the real world, do match our like return and profitability expectation. And we did that work knowing the result would most likely be what we were expecting, and it just confirmed. So yes, it increases our level of conviction and comfort about the way we look at the company, that's comforting our opinion. But it's very often more important than, you know, increasing our price target or forecast or anything like that.
Right, for sure. Because as you're saying these things, I'm wondering, you know, how things may have changed in the last 6 months to a year, let's call it, really since Battery Day, and since we got more insight into the rate of growth that Tesla has shown with the gigafactories that they're building out now. So obviously Giga Shanghai is the one having an impact now, but hopefully next year we'll see similar impacts from, you know, Berlin and Texas as well. So I know, I don't know which conference call it was on, but I think maybe Q4 or Q3, you'd ask Elon about guidance for 2021, saying somewhere between like 900,000 and, you know, 1.1 million or something like that. And he was like, yeah, that's pretty much in the ballpark, which going back a couple of years, I don't know that that would have been, you know, the type of forecast that a lot of people were putting out for that point in time, certainly in the analyst community.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, you have this very interesting phenomenon that you can see that happening for years and years and years, which is you have a certain forecast, you have a certain consensus expectation on Tesla. My view is that it's going to revise up every year. So you have companies that are growing revenues 20% a year, and then you have companies that are seeing their forecast expectations increasing by 20% every year. And that's a big difference between the two. For sure. And you have domains where this is happening. So I think it's true for definitely true for Tesla. Another area today where it's happening is actually renewable energy. It's hilarious to say that we published some research not like a few weeks ago on the acceleration. Like we think we are arriving at a tipping point for the deployment of renewable energy. And we came out with a forecast like a 2030 to 2050 forecast that is about 10x any other forecast. And so people are laughing at us, like in the industry, like people at the International Energy Agency and stuff like that. And we're like, yeah, you can laugh at us, but look at slide 17. And our slide 17, we show that over the last 10 years, forecasts have increased 10x. So every year, forecast is increasing by 20%. Right. After 10 years, 20% compounded for 10 years, that's 10x. So we're just saying what you've been doing for 10 years, you're going to keep doing it, and that's fine. That's the way you should do it, because you're not going to say today, I believe in a world in which things are 10 times larger, because then people would challenge you about there are no fabs for that. There is not enough silicon. There is not enough everything. But yeah, but we have 10 years. So let's increase that forecast year by year. So like Tesla today, I don't want to be too specific about our own expectations, to avoid getting into trouble with regulators. But what you can see as a fact that Tesla said 1 million unit production capacity at the beginning of this year, and consensus expects maybe 800,000 units or something like that to be produced this year. So if you ask that question, being a bit cheeky with Elon, yes, Elon is tempted to tell you, yes, of course, it's wrong. And then Zach is trying to stop him from saying more. But you look at next year. So next year, at the beginning of the year, plus minus 3 months, you'll have Austin and Berlin ramping. So these are an additional at least 500,000 unit production capacity ramping. And you see that Tesla seems to be, Elon seems to be like traveling around the world and looking at places where to put an additional factory. So by then, there will be another factory or two other factory ramping up. And so the little game is going to keep playing for a few years, for sure. And yep. And it's going to stop only the day Tesla feels like we're getting to the, you know, to the bottom of our market. We may not want to add a factory because maybe we won't find enough people buying our cars. And that is not around the corner for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's mind blowing to me is like, I think the Wall Street consensus is somewhere around for 2025, like 2.3 million deliveries, I want to say. And the average price target $600. And it's just like, it's pretty clear Tesla's going to be ahead of 2.3 million by that point, barring some, you know, significant disruption in their growth plans. So,
Yeah. And it's going to take a few years for that number to click up. It's not going to get corrected tomorrow for sure. And that's good. Yeah. That's what it's made for.
Yeah. It allows investors that are bullish on the company to have a lower price to get in at, allows Tesla to not disappoint on their expectations, which I think is healthy. So that's great.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So switching gears a little bit, you have a Model Y on order, or have you guys taken delivery yet?
Oh yeah, no, we got it. Yes, we got it a few weeks back. Yes, absolutely.
How are you liking it?
First Tesla, right? It's very nice. Oh no, that's my third Tesla.
Oh, all right.
I had the Model X number 402, so one of the I think it was the first one on the East Coast. It was a performance model, like a signature Model X. So it was fun. Borderline.
Yeah, so you go way back then. I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And then we swapped that for a Model 3 as soon as the Model 3 got available because we wanted to try it. And then we were waiting for the Model Y to be available with 7 seats because I have 5 kids before switching to the Model Y, and we have the Model Y. And we can't wait to get the Cybertruck. It's
How's the 7-seater working out for you guys?
So it is like the last 2 seats are really, really tiny. So it's really for very, 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 very skinny, young, and short kids. But that's okay. But there is plenty of room. Like the way the seats fold is very, very convenient. So we love it. And the interior of the Model Y is extremely, extremely nicely. Like the volumes are very enjoyable. So it's a very comfortable car. I really love it. Yeah, no doubt.
Awesome. I kind of have to ask, what are you hearing about cryptocurrency? Are people caring about Elon talking about this all the time? Or is it kind of just like people shrugging it off? Or
yeah, that's a good question. So I have personally an extremely low level of interest in cryptocurrency. I completely respect beautiful intellectual construction and the fact that creating like a virtual safe haven currency with like very, very strong, very fundamental mechanism of like limited discovery and very high level of distributed safety and all that independent from any sort of economic of political power. I admire people who invented that and people who, you know, keep building on the concept. I am also very intrigued by the broader blockchain technology and the fact that you can create a distributed ledger like that. I find it very intriguing and very interesting. But I don't believe in cryptocurrency as like a safe haven assets. For like a very obscure reason, it's because I think a safe haven asset needs to have like an anthropological value. It needs to have a value that you have in that we have in our essence for like thousands of years and parts of the mystery of our very essence. And I think gold qualifies to that, and diamonds qualify to that. The cryptocurrency doesn't. And that's actually when I see today's volatility, I'm kind of thinking that's probably a reflection of that. You know, when gold prices come down, you stay calm and they can halve, of course, but it would take them like, take gold maybe multiple years to halve in prices. And in cryptocurrency, things move much, much faster because you have like this lack of tangible anthropological value in it. So for that reason, I'm like, I don't take a view. I'm not bullish. I'm not bearish. I just ignore it. So the fact that Tesla got involved in that, I'm not a big fan, to be honest. You know, I had the conversation with them and I thought, you know, well, I asked them, why did you do it? And I told them what I was thinking of it. And so, you know, their official response about why they did it was really like inflation edge, which I think is a valid and respectable argument. My personal, you know, hinge, my personal feeling is that, yes, maybe it's an inflation edge, but I think it's a great marketing coup. You know, you buy $1.5 billion of Bitcoin. I don't think it's a massively risky bet to make. And I mean, they could lose some money in there, but to the scale of Tesla, it's an extremely small thing to do. Remember that Tesla is not spending on marketing 2% of their revenues. So, you know, who cares about $1.5 billion, even if they lose everything. And I think the impact of that on marketing in terms of brand awareness and is actually extremely, extremely strong. And so, you know, whatever happens with Bitcoin, all the benefit of the headline visibility that Tesla got on that is still very, very powerful. I tend to have this very cynical interpretation of a lot of what Tesla does on many topics. I don't believe in robotaxi, for instance. I don't think Tesla can become a robotaxi company. It doesn't stop me from being very, very optimistic about the company and the stock, but I don't believe in that story. I struggle to believe Elon really believes in it. But I think it makes a lot of sense to have that as an ambition because it's a beautiful ambition. And that's setting a high target for everybody. And that's creating this massive buzz about the technology And you know, a technology like Autopilot, you want people to dream about it, and you want to generate adoption, because the more people adopt it, the more you are in a position to improve the quality of the product. And so that, I do believe in Autopilot a lot, and Autopilot is like a massive potential upside. But it doesn't necessarily mean like you're going to have your car doing like Uber while you're playing golf. That part of the story, I don't really believe in it.
Right. And that's something we talked about a long time ago for people that are curious in the first conversation we had. So I don't think we need to go through all the details of that if people are wondering, but
And then there's one last element, I would say, observation, is that if last week you had about $1 trillion of Bitcoin out there, and you still have maybe $500 billion of Bitcoin out there. It's a lot of money. And so if you're on the forefront of that community that owns Bitcoins, and if you're able to take Bitcoins as payments for cars, it's actually unlocking a massive market. And so being active from that perspective probably makes a lot of sense. And now the thing is that it's very dangerous ground. So like Tesla has sold many cars that got paid in Bitcoins. And what I assume is that they felt they had to stop that because that was becoming too much of an exposure, too much of a risk for the business. And their least problem today is to find buyers. Okay, like people are waiting in line to buy Tesla cars. So they probably put an end to that, but they might just still keep a very constructive eye on cryptocurrency and come back and be able to actually sell cars for cryptocurrency. And if they do that, I think it's actually a massive, it can be a massive boost to their opportunity as well. So shouldn't ignore that. So I really have like a very, I'm not a fan, but I'm not negative either on it. And I keep an eye and see development, and let's see what happens.
Sure. Some pros, some cons. Makes sense. What else? Is there anything, you know, that people are concerned about that you're hearing? You know, I'm sure supply chain issues kind of the overarching concern that I'm seeing out there. Is that kind of what you're hearing too? Logistics and supply chains?
Yes, exactly. So the logistics and supply chain is a concern. My view is that, you know, it's a very uneven constraint. It's like extremely painful for a Ford or a GM, and like Japanese makers barely, they see the constraint, but they don't feel like they have to guide down for it. So not all car manufacturers are exposed the same way. I think for Tesla, it's probably going to be easier to navigate on a relative basis. It's going to be tough, but it's going to be easier to navigate than with others. And that doesn't shake my kind of perspective on how many cars at least Tesla wants to manufacture this year, because their largest semiconductor supplier is probably STMicro, who sells them the silicon carbide chips they need for the inverter of all their cars. And STMicro has been pretty specific about what kind of revenues they expect in silicon carbide, and by backing that out with my own knowledge of, you know, how much silicon carbide per car you need, etc., I came to the conclusion STMicro was implicitly saying we expect Tesla to buy us for at least 1 million cars. So, you know, that's the beauty of this supply constrained situation, which is your constraint in terms of, I was planning to get 100, I'm going to get 95. Okay, so if the 100 Tesla was planning to get is 800,000 units, that's going to be disappointing. But if Tesla was planning to get 1.2 million, then if they get only 95% of that, we're going to be pretty happy about it. So I think they're going to be hit only if they do extremely well,
which is not going
to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that tweet from a few weeks back, and we covered it on Tesla Daily for sure. How confident are you? Do you feel like that's like a range that has a really narrow band where you're pretty confident in it, or is that, you know, something that's pretty wide, has a lot of variability to it?
What, the production for this year, or
for the silicon carbide chips they're talking about here.
That's a very good question. I would say that the lower bound being 1 million in terms of interpreting what STMicro expects, and they might be expecting wrong, so that right, I don't know. Right. But the lower bound being 1 million car, I can't see how I could get that wrong. And what I could get wrong is that it might be 1.2 million, but okay, it can't be 800. So the low end, and the reason for that is that I know how much they made last year, roughly. And they said, we're going to make 2x this year. And last year, Tesla sold 500,000 cars. And the cost of these chips, as you go in time and grow volumes, they don't go up, they go down. So you're like, yeah, it's very, very difficult to imagine there would be less than 1 million for this year for that reason. You know, so you don't even need to know that that many details about how much is this chip, how many chips. Like, we do this math as well, of course. But like at a high level, like the 1 million feels to me like if Tesla doesn't make 1 million cars, STMicro is not going to make the revenue they've kind of announced on silicon carbide. That I feel relatively confident about it.
The only thing that I can see throwing some weirdness into that is if they like picked up another client or something, but you don't think that?
No, they did. And I actually took that into account in my math. But the thing that the silicon carbide market, to give you an idea, so this year, STMicro is going to do, I think they said at least $550 million. This year, Infineon is going to do $180 million. And Cree is going to do $150 million. So you see, Tesla is more than the overall market combined. So if there were a client that would move the needle in a game of doubling Tesla, I mean, we follow that market. We follow Infineon, we follow Wall Street. We are like fairly deep in power semiconductors. It can't happen without us seeing it. It's like very, it's like gigantic volumes to the scale of that market. So that's what the IR of STMicro will tell you, because they feel like, oh, we've been guiding for Tesla, it's not good. But like, if you know the market, you know that moving part cannot be very big. It can be a few tens of millions. It cannot be 100 million.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And even so, that's why you're saying tens of million is a lot.
Yeah, so that's kind of why you're saying, okay, doubling, if the price is held the same, which they shouldn't, they should come down in price, then mm-hmm. it would go to, from, you know, 500,000 to 1 million. And mm-hmm. if the prices actually go down, then that's why you're saying you'd miss to the upside, because, okay, maybe that doubling in revenues for them is actually, if the unit cost comes down a little bit, which it should, maybe that's something more like 1.2. Does that make sense?
Yes, exactly. And so, yes, and 1.2 would be a mix of they don't win additional clients at all, and prices are coming down quite a good deal, like that at least 10%, so, which is probably a bit bullish. So I would say between 1 and 1.2, I'm very confident in 1, and 1.2 is probably a stretch.
Yeah,
but
that makes sense.
Still where, you know, up to where it would make sense.
Would Tesla take delivery of those, you know, significantly ahead of production? So let's say Tesla produces 900,000, but they needed to have that supply yes. chain built in there.
That's actually what I was about to say, which is this 1 million units, they might run from February 1st to February 1st, or March 1st to March 1st, instead of Jan 1st to Jan 1st. So that's one thing where they could do 950 and STMicro would still do their numbers. But you see, you would be, yeah. So, you know, that's still, there is still that kind of room. Yeah.
Right. And at the end of the day, it's like, okay, 1 month time shift doesn't really matter too much. Like,
no,
investors yes, looking exactly. at the quarterly earnings are going to care about it, but you know, 3 years from now, that's stuff like that's not going to matter.
Yeah, it's a very important point you make, because you end up being an analyst covering Tesla, and so you build a whole way of understanding how the business is running, and you're like, yeah, but they're going to make 1 million cars. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Like, okay, plus minus a couple of months, maybe. So that will matter a lot on what they print, but that doesn't challenge my understanding of how the business runs. And then you suddenly hear like a supplier saying something that is exactly in line with what you said. And then you ask a sneaky question on the call and you can feel the CEO gets excited by the question. And you're like, I don't really care about how many cars they produce this year. What I care about is that the framework in which we understand and model the company and try and, you know, outthink what happens next and better understand than other analysts or faster for our clients. What happens next at Tesla, that framework seems to be like the more you get data points like that, the more confident you feel about your framework. That's what really matters in like plus minus 1 month.
Yeah, totally agree. I think that's a perfect place to leave it then, Pierre. Thanks so much for coming on. This was a super enjoyable conversation. I think we're, you know, lucky to have you sharing this knowledge with us.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks a lot. It's always a pleasure. And we stay in touch.